Blog Talk Radio.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Blitzkrieg broadcast here at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. It's great to have you here with me this Monday evening. It's December 9th, 2013. Please do be sure to check out all of the other great hosts here at Renegade Broadcasting. The lineup is right up there at the top. Click on the host you'd like to listen to, and you'll find all of their archives, and there's a contact button on the side if you have any questions. Also, please be sure to check out RenegadeTribune.com, WhiteManMarch.com, AlternativeSocial.com, and ArianWomen.com. Tonight, I have a special guest. I have Tan Stoffel from Age of Treason Radio, which is over on the White Network. And I suggest you all check out the link that I provided in the show description for tonight, the link to Age of Treason Radio, which is actually a compilation of quite a few shows that Tan Stoffel has done over the past year. And it's called The Jews, Who, What, Why, and How. They're very interesting programs. They're short. They're about 30 minutes. And a lot of really in-depth research looking into the Jews and their relationship to us. So he's been doing some great work over there at the White Network, and we'll be getting into quite a few topics tonight. Tan Stoffel, thank you for joining me tonight.
Hey, thanks, Carl. Good to be here to talk with you. I'm looking forward to it.
Before we get into anything too in-depth, let's talk about your name. I'm guessing that it's an acronym. I think it would be for there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. I just didn't know if it was some name I had never heard of, but I'm glad I got that right.
Well, so, I describe it in the very first podcast that I did for Age of Treason Radio. So if anyone's interested about that or other details of my background, they can consult that very first episode where I talk about things like that.
Great. So how many years have you been at this then?
Well, podcasting, I started in June of 2012, so a little over a year and a half, I guess, or getting close to a year and a half now. And before that, I was blogging, although I can't say that all of my blogging, since which started in the wake of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, I remember pretty distinctly, you know, finally reaching a point where I wanted to vent more publicly, and so started this blog, Age of Treason. And at the time, though, I was not really racially awake, and I didn't yet understand the Jews as our enemies. So, you know, you can see in that blog my transition from conservative patriotard to where I am today. Follow it every step along the way.
Yeah, for those of us who have been blogging for a few years, that transition becomes very evident. And yeah. It's just so great to see more and more people making this kind of transition, maybe going through a few different phases to get here, but however it is they find it, they're ending up with this realization that, well, the Jews have an inordinate amount of control and influence in almost every single sector of our world, and they particularly dislike white people and have a very destructive agenda that is aimed right at us.
Yes.
It requires jumping over quite a few hurdles, though. Things that they've set up for us, even just words that that we're just so scared of, and they've been really demonizing anybody that has been speaking about such issues for so long over the years through their media mouthpieces, through their movies, through their articles, that you know, it took a while for the first kind of their line of defenses to be breached. But once that happened and more people started going through, it kind of opened up the floodgates, I think.
Yeah, that's an apt metaphor. But, you know, what you're saying is true, that the Jewish power is, once your eyes are open to it, it's everywhere. It's around us. It's in the news every day, their influence. And it's really hard to imagine why people don't see it. And in fact, I think people do see it, but they actively push it down. They actively don't want to think about it. They push it out of their minds because I think they realize the penalties for recognizing it openly and speaking against it openly. And therefore, they don't. You know, I can only judge based on my own history, what I went through. And I realize, though, that other people are different and see it differently. There are people who were from birth raised by parents who were well aware and told them all along what was going on, told them the score. And so they had a leg up on the rest of us, and good for them. But I think there are a lot of people like myself, and there's a lot of people coming behind us that still are in the dark and still don't realize it and still deny when you talk to them, as I do often privately, speaking to friends and family about these issues, you get this sort of denial. The argument starts off with, oh, you're crazy, the Jews don't run anything. And by the end of the conversation, they're screaming at you that you're just jealous of the Jews.
Right.
You just want to do what the Jews are doing, you know, acknowledging that the Jews are doing something and that they do have power, and that then the accusation has turned into, well, you're just a bad person because you want to be like them, implicitly assuming they're bad.
Let's get into Jewish power. But first, I just wanted to say that it's amazing how Jews can claim that once they admit that, yes, we do have a large amount of control, disproportionate to our numbers, but it's just because we're so hardworking. It's because we are just talented. We're good at communications. That's why we're all over the media. Don't hate us for being superior in these things. But if white people were to say that same line about themselves and why they have dominated certain professions throughout the years, then that is considered incredibly racist. We are all equal. How dare you? And we will further equalize you by giving more unqualified people your jobs.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there is truth in the explanation that you say that they give. They do give that explanation. Their communication skills, that's one of the things that they're very good with, is their adept at language, and both written and spoken, and with argument, and using arguments to their advantage, even if they're not necessarily logical arguments, but just playing on people's emotions and psychology. And they're very energetic people. The secret to their success is that they're doing the right thing the right way, at least right from their point of view, as far as identifying as a group and then doing what's in the group's best interest, that's their guiding principle.
Yes. So they have great networks set up Jews for Jews. And sometimes they allow other races to be kind of on the auxiliary of these networks, mainly, I think, just to disenfranchise the white man who used to be there. But I wouldn't say that they're in these positions simply because they work harder than us or that they're more intelligent. I think that the kind of the cronyism is what gets them there, and it's not an open free marketplace where really the best person gets the job. It's the person with the Jewish last name,
yeah.
Or if they're a crypto, it's the person who's actually Jewish and plays off being white who gets the job. And I think that if we were to have a similar network amongst whites, it would be absolutely amazing what we'd be able to accomplish simply by having our own ethnic groups with which we do business.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely ethnic networking. Ethnic nepotism is a big part of it, not just innate individual ability and IQ or something. And some of that also just comes naturally. I remember when I was deracinated, I wasn't thinking in terms of race, and I had power over who to hire and fire, that I tended to surround myself with other white guys just because that's who I related best to. And as far as creating a team to accomplish a goal, you want other people that have a certain skill set and have a certain compatibility with each other. And so there's some of that too. But one of the things that the Jews do very, very effectively is destroy or at least undermine anybody else doing the same thing that they're doing. They recognize very well that this is a strength, this ethnic networking and nepotism, and they can detect it. They have these antennae that are super sensitive to anybody else doing anything similar. And so that's where the other side of the coin that you started off with describing, that they criticize whites for trying to do or even explain or justify, you know, doing anything similar to what they do, because they realize that it's successful and that they realize that they aren't us, that they're opposed to us, and that they see it as a sort of zero-sum game, that if we gain, then they must lose. And if they gain, that we have to lose. Whites have to lose. So,
yes. So I'd like to get into the argument against white nationalism or against white networking, which is what many of us are seeking, and that is that you can't defeat the Jews by acting like Jews. And what they're doing is trying to discourage us from viewing ourselves as white, because that's what those evil Zionists over there in Israel do. So they might agree with us that Israel is a very destructive ally to have, but they think of it for the wrong reasons. They think Israel's terrible because they're so racist, and we should never act like that. Whereas I see it as whites need to basically do what every other racial group on this planet already does instinctively. Many of these other racial groups aren't browbeaten and propagandized to loathe their own races. So it's pretty much only the white people who don't have some kind of sense of racial identity and loyalty. And it's not just the Jews who does.
Right. At this point in history, it is whites who our biggest fault from a white point of view is that we don't have that ethnic nepotism, that racial solidarity that all the other groups seem to have. And oddly enough, even people of color, this completely artificial mishmash of other races, which people of color simply means not white. It's the sort of antithesis to white. They somehow have enough sense to bond together against the white enemy. And despite their racial differences and despite the fighting that they would do without a white enemy, and because they have that white enemy, that's what helps bond them together. But my point is that white people seem to have even less of a sense of ourselves and togetherness in a common cause than people of color do.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because although these groups will still kind of identify with their own particular kind of niche group, whether it's Mexicans will allow themselves to be grouped in with a larger, kind of non-white group, people of color, when it benefits them. But they really, when it comes down to it, are very closely tied to their, to their mongrelized kin, the mestizo kin, because it's not about just being Mexican. It's really for them about being mestizo. I don't think they really connect with the white Mexicans that are down there, and oftentimes those white Mexicans actually have more racial identity than whites in America, because they're really living around the shorter, browner elements, and haven't been convinced that they need to mix it all up with them and invite them in to be their best friends and neighbors. So it's interesting, this kind of grouping that has been compiled to fight against not just white people, but specifically the white man. And you see how they do this. They do it through diversity programs, which includes white women. Everybody needs to get a leg up on the white man, because he's just been so dominant for so long. So we'll team up the white women with handicapped people in wheelchairs, with mestizos, with the black people, with immigrants from any nation, with homosexuals, with any kind of special interest group against white people. So it's quite unfair, I'd say, but we've kind of allowed this to happen to ourselves without saying too much or doing too much to stop it over the years, which kind of indicates to me that Jewish power needs to rely upon white power going along with it in its agenda. And Jewish power has been enabled specifically by white people, and therefore I think it's also our responsibility to see that it gets put into check.
Well, there's a couple of things here. There's two halves to it. There's the coalition building that Jews do that you're talking about, and forming things like this quote-unquote people of color coalition. But the coalition, as you rightly point out, would fly apart without the Jewish organizing to it, and without the Jewish propaganda justifying it and legitimatizing it. It would fly apart of its own natural forces. And on the other side, the flip side, is the divide and conquer nature of these attacks on what's left is this rump, this of white men. And yes, we should be proud of our accomplishments, but you see that we're the last group that's not protected. You know, the women have been divided from us, the homosexuals have been separated out, Christians have been attacked and separated out, in addition to all the other groups. And so, you know, really, there's a small core left. The Jewish narrative is really the guiding force here, and you have to give the Jews credit for being an adversary and not simply taking advantage of some failing of white people. These people have an active agenda of their own that they've been pursuing for millennia, and they've outlasted dozens societies in that period of time, in 2,000 to 4,000 years. So it's not like the white man somehow got drunk one day and left the keys to his car with the Jews, and the Jews took it and drove us all off the cliff. That's, I don't think, really an accurate way to describe it. It's more like and it falls into the a dangerous way of thinking, I think, of this sort of solipsistic way of thinking that whites are really the only force in the world. And as much as soothing as that is to whites, especially people who are pro-white, proud to be white, to think that if we just wanted to, if we just got our shit together, we could, you know, kick out all the rats and deal with all the traitors and set things right, that I think it's more complicated than that. And I think the main point that I want to make is that we have an adversary, that it's not just we're not alone in the room screwing up and other people taking advantage of it. It's actually a competition. It's a competition between, and that's where the hostility comes from. It's from groups who think that they don't need us, who don't even really think in those terms. They're so concerned with their own interests that we are less than human in their minds. And so anything that they need to do for their own best interests, they do. They're thinking about it all the time. They see even the slightest resistance here or there, and they immediately move in to dismantle and destroy it. And they have no qualms about doing so. They are very subtle, though, at times, and they realize that they have to do it by stealth because they risk waking up too many people at one time. And that is maybe the one hope that we have is in the fact that they are acting as puppet masters at the top. It's a precarious position for them to be in because although they control the strings, if the people that they're controlling, the puppets that they're controlling, ever come to realize the manipulation that they've been subjected to, not just in their lifetimes, but for generations now, and throw off those strings and vent their frustrations with those puppet masters, take it out on the puppet masters, that that would be the big change that that I'd be looking forward to.
Well, the way I see it is that the white man or the white people around the world have been pretty much set up as a scapegoat for the Jews. Whenever they do anything bad, they pretend like they're white if they get caught. And so, oh, just another evil white guy scheming and scamming. But when they're trying to kind of cozy up to some of the quote-unquote minority groups, they like to play the victim card. Oh, we were Holocausted. We've been victims of this white oppression as well. They don't really talk about how they're the number one diamond traders in the entire world, so they're funding a lot of that black conflict in Africa. They don't really like to try to play themselves up as being these big and powerful people when they're courting these kinds of bedfellows. But the way I see it is that these bedfellows really only deal with them because the Jews are giving these minority groups special favors, special deals, special ways to get at our money. So if somehow we were able to actually show these other groups exactly what's going on and make some kind of deal with them and just get rid of the Jews as being these puppet masters, then we could actually have, I think, a lot more racial harmony within this world. And, of course, a lot of these unnecessary wars would come to an end, which would make a lot of these groups, I think, rather happy. So I do think that this is starting to happen as more and more people start looking at the Jews a little bit more critically.
Yeah, I think one hope is that the white elite, who really can't operate at elite levels without rubbing elbows with the Jews. I mean, they are conscious of the Jews because to not be conscious of the Jews is to open yourself up to making dangerous statements that get you fired. So they are well aware of who they're working with. I think that they've just convinced themselves that the Jews are allies and partners, and hey, they're white, you know, like us, and they cannot accept this really kind of earth-shattering, different way of seeing reality, which is that no, the Jews aren't us. They're not white. they really don't like white people. They see us as a resource to be exploited, not as a race that they have anything in common with. In fact, this Jewish narrative that I mentioned is their storytelling, their way of seeing their history in the last 2,000 years amongst Europeans as this one long tale of woe, of their suffering at the hands of Europeans. And it's always, it's the Europeans' fault entirely for all of that suffering. It's not the Jews' fault because they're purely innocent. And this is the narrative that they've now turned into a sort of template. They've generalized it, and they've handed it to the blacks, and they've handed it to the Hispanics, and they've handed it to the even to the Muslims to a certain extent. They see this Jewish playbook, and they see, oh, well, we just have to change the word Jew to some other word. And the Jews go along with it to a certain extent. Their story of oppression with oppressors on one side and the oppressed on the other is generalized into a story of whites are the oppressors and the non-whites are the oppressed. And as you say, when they are talking in their media about some scandal that happens, if there are a bunch of Jews involved, they'll describe them as whites to direct the anger at the malfeasance at whites in general.
Or with George Zimmerman, out comes a new term, white Hispanic. Whatever they can do to blame it on white people, they're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think that was they went a little too far in that that collective decision to make George Zimmerman be a poster boy for white racism, because I think even a lot of white people that were thinking hard not to think racist thoughts have been pushed to their limit. You know, my limit was back in the wake of Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, you had all of these blacks acting like animals when the law breaks down. And yet the media was busy blaming whites, and specifically George Bush for not reacting quickly enough. And for me, even as a deracinated white person, I said, hey, you know, this isn't right. This isn't fair. This isn't what's really wrong. What's wrong is that blacks act like animals. The minute that, you know, the police or civil society breaks down, blacks see it as an opportunity to rampage. And, you know, the L.A. riots and New York City riots when there's blackouts. And throughout my life, I had seen these things happen, and they made me feel a certain way. But it wasn't until much later in life that it sort of clicked finally. The final straw that broke the camel's back came along. And for a lot of people that are coming up, and maybe some of them are older than me, and a lot that are younger, they saw this whole Trayvon Zimmerman thing as the straw that broke their back. And they just, you know, they're realizing now that white people just are never going to be able to please the biased the liberal media. And quite a few of them, I'm sure, are thinking now, this liberal media, what does that mean exactly, liberal media? And some of them are figuring out that it means a Jewish media, and it means it's Jews that don't like whites. It's not just liberals.
So let's get into how the media is now taking this knockout game and using it as probably a distraction for more important stories, though I feel like black violence is a very important story. But the way that they're framing it now, it's all about how Negroes are committing all sorts of violence against the poor Jews who are always being persecuted. So even though it was the Jews who started and ran the NAACP and were behind all sorts of different revolutionary movements, and this would get into the liberation theology, which I think you were alluding to partly before, they were the ones really behind this. And now that blacks are getting even out of control, apparently, allegedly, sometimes within Jewish communities, that's what they're focusing on now. And it's making it seem like even though they're reporting – well, it's making it seem like they're reporting on the entirety of the violence that is going on when they report on these stories, meaning they're not even letting people know that there are, in addition to these knockouts that are taking place, there are daily many, many rapes, murders, robberies, tortures, kidnappings that are inflicted upon the white people of this country by black people and by illegal aliens, but it just goes unreported. So I really am always a little bit worried when I see the media taking a racially charged story and spinning it around. I think that it's a good sign that they're even covering this, but hopefully enough people will be able to see through the kinds of twists and turns that that the media is taking them with. And then on the other side of this mainstream media is allegedly the alternative, which is Russia Today. And a recent report by Russia Today labels the knockout game a myth. So it's an interesting kind of situation we see ourselves in right now with, with the media responding to this increase in violent crime, or at least the increased awareness to violent crime being committed against white people. And again, it's lumping in the Jews with the whites here.
Yeah, and of course it's the Jews media. It's largely owned and manned by Jews, and even the people who aren't Jews realize that they'd better not say anything negative about the Jews or they'll lose their job and their role in that Jews media. A couple of things about this whole knockout game thing is, yet you're right that it's been going on for a very long time. It's really just the latest faddish name for the kind of black violence that goes back to the dawn of having blacks anywhere near whites. And it's just a sign, I think, of how thoroughly we've lost control over our society that this sort of thing is even tolerated. The Occidental Observer had a good article titled something like "The Blankout Game versus the Knockout Game," and it made a point that hand in hand with this knockout game, what enables it is that whites walk around disarmed. We pretend that we are under no threat, that everybody is the same, and that we're as safe amongst walking in a mall full of blacks as we would be walking in a mall full of white people. And I think most people, most white people, are actually conscious that that's wrong. They get a bad sense in their gut that makes them try to get out of those situations. I mean, that's what's behind white flight is even if they won't talk about it in racial terms, they will physically move their family at great expense to get away from it. But the point that I think it was Colin Liddell was the author of that article made about the blankout game is that whites consciously put that out of their minds and pretend and make ourselves victims by through that pretense, rather than preparing ourselves, rather than avoiding the situation to begin with or fighting back in any way. We just sort of look straight ahead and pretend that we're okay and that the blacks are really sucker punching, their sucker punching is taking advantage of that blankout. And my thought in response to that is that's a great point, but you know what? It goes a step beyond that. It goes two steps at least beyond that. The one is this blankout extends to the media and the fact that the media is blanking out reporting of these attacks and is the source of a lot of this wishful thinking that, you know, we live in a society of equals who are and violence being done to us is just random. It isn't disproportionately black and so forth. And the second kind of blank out that's going on is there's this denial that it's Jews that run the media and that's why people blank out talking about the media being responsible for not reporting on this. You know, if you had a media that was actually run by, you had a society of homogenous in your ethnic group, and then you had a media that was taken from that homogenous ethnic group, there would be a lot more honest reporting, and there would be a lot more people calling to account anybody who wasn't honestly reporting on the facts as they were, either leaving things out or distorting things. But we don't have that. We have there isn't anyone within the media, because it's the Jews media, that who actually points out these kind of distortions that the Jews media makes.
Well, I think people are starting to see this also with the immigration debate, in that there really isn't one. Between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, between MSNBC and Fox News, it's not about whether or not we should allow these illegal people into our countries and make them all citizens. It's really about how many of them we should allow in and when. So people are getting really frustrated that they can't even talk about removing tens and tens of millions of illegal people from their country, because it's, as you said, it's not their media that's being shown everywhere. If it was, there'd be a serious discussion about whether or not all of these massive waves of immigrants would be welcomed.
Yeah, that was another straw that broke my back on race and the Jews was after Katrina, within the 2 years or so afterwards, I became very concerned about immigration and was going to demonstrations and joining organizations and so forth, reading a lot about it and writing a lot about it in my blog. And I eventually figured out that, you know, it's not that the leadership, it's not that the media is not aware, and it's not that the elected officials are not aware of what the what's right and what's wrong, and, you know, the fact that the government is supposed to defend its people. If there's one responsibility that any government has, it's to defend its polity, the people that it's supposed to represent, and the citizenry. And once I figured out that they weren't doing that, it wasn't out of ignorance, it was deliberate, and it had been going on for a long time, I came to the obvious conclusion that the government is illegitimate. It doesn't represent the interests of the people it governs over. And
right.
So in that very basic sense, it's illegitimate. And that was before I figured out race. That was before I figured out the Jews or who. But it was another essential stepping stone in my own migration toward where I am today. It was later that I figured out that, the Jews and their influence and race.
Yeah, well, it should be very obvious to anybody looking at the president, half Kenyan, likely half Jew, who sides with illegal immigrants over the citizens of his own country that he's representing, both white and black. He's going on, you know, going to the illegal immigrant rally where they're hunger striking. There are illegal aliens in Congress. It's just amazing that they break the laws of this country and then invited in to make a statement in our Congress. And so it shows how these different groups have really teamed up against us. And it doesn't help out the low-level blacks out there to have wave after wave of immigrant hordes. It's not in anybody who is an American citizen's interest to have this happen. And yet, there's no discussion upon it. At least none that is productive, none that is realistic. And so we have a completely hostile government, media, and all the other institutions, hostile forces allied against us and our interests. Nobody is out there representing us. They might pretend to, but even now the Republican Party, even though white people voted 70% for Mitt Romney, those who did vote, even though that is the case, now they're continuing to try to cozy up to the Mexicans. They think that that's the way to success, and that's why you're seeing more and more of these Hispanic politicians, Marco Rubio and all of the rest. They're trying to now get the diversity vote instead even seeking to try to consolidate what they once had or
I don't think that they're doing it for the vote, and I don't think that they're doing it because they think it's right or moral or ethical or anything like that. I think they're doing it in spite of the fact that they probably sense that it's actually a violation of their the rhetoric. That they're doing it because, you know, what I said about a government is supposed to represent its polity, politicians have their constituency, the people that they think of that they're representing, right? It's really just that they are answering to a constituency. They are doing what what they think that their constituency wants of them. And these other things are just rationalizations, these public statements that they make explaining it. Their constituency are the people who fund them, fund their campaigns, who keep them in power, who got them into power to begin with, and would remove them from power pretty quickly if they were to violate their desires. And so that's who they're really doing this for. And it's the leadership of both parties. It's the major corporations, the major media in the United States. You're right. It's all aligned in favor of immigration. And it's changed so radically that in 1964, when the law that was passed that really cracked open the United States, it's really what undid the United States, although the roots of it go back much farther than that. But in 64, when that law changed, Ted Kennedy, who was just a young man at the time, I just recently voted into the Senate, has made this famous statement about, you know, some of our, and this was in the wake of the thing passing, he said sort of triumphantly that some of our opponents have said that this is going to change the ethnic makeup of this country and it's going to bring in 1 million immigrants a year, and that's not true, that's not what's going to happen. And 20 years later, in around 85, 86, when the amnesty went through, they were talking about how it was like there were going to be 1.5, you know, there's too many illegal aliens here. We got to do something about it. But the right thing to do is, you know, these people, they want to be here. They can make good Americans. Let's just amnesty them, do what's right. And so they said there's going to be 1.5 million. It turned out there were 3 million. And they had, of course, the, you know, the enforcement that they were going to go along with. They forgot about the enforcement. They didn't enforce the laws at all. But by that point, my point is 20 years later, it had already changed. The attitude about immigration that in the past, up until 65, it had been that a country, any country that wants to remain a country, has to control its borders. And if it lets immigrants into the country, it's for the benefit of that country. I mean, and it's up to the citizens of that country to decide how much immigration to let in, and it should always be done from the basis, the point of view of, if it's good for us as a people, then it should be allowed. And it's gone, even in the 20 years to 85, it was already starting to shift to, hey, we got to do what's right for everybody. Well, 20 years on beyond that, and it was about 2006, 2007, that immigration heated up again. Another big amnesty was coming down the tracks. And by that point, Ted Kennedy was still alive, although he was toward the end of his life now. He had changed his tune so 180 degrees, and of course the situation had changed 180 degrees. The ethnic makeup of the United States was radically changed in that 40-year period. And now it was something to celebrate. It went from something that, oh, only crazy people think that's even going to happen. Of course, nobody would want the ethnic makeup of the United States to change. Nobody would want 1 million immigrants a year to come. That was the implicit thing that he was saying back then. And he was one of the proponents of the change, the law being changed. 40 years later, it was all out in the open already. Okay, done deal. There's no turning back now. And by the way, anybody who thinks that this is a bad thing, they're a bad person. They're crazy and stupid and rotten, and they should be excluded from the political process. And another famous statement that he made, although I can't find any record of it written, it was broadcast at the time live, was his statement when the immigration reform bill at the time went down in flames finally, when you know, so many people called the Congress and melted down their phone lines, is he said, what do our opponents want? They want to load up all the non-white people into buses and ship them off to concentration camps. They want a Gestapo to do this. And I remember thinking at the time, I really didn't have very negative feelings about Jews or very positive feelings about Nazis. But I thought, boy, this is way over the top. He's crazy. He's crazy. He's trying to point fingers at other people that are crazy. He was really incensed with this idea that their whole thing had gone down in flames. Well, here we are another 7 years down the road, and I think that they've kind of resigned themselves. They keep pushing for it, and this push is the most blatant in the direction of, we got to do now what's best for the immigrants. It's really about doing what's right for the immigrants. Of course, it still isn't. It's not the immigrants. It's the crust at the very top of the pyramid, mostly Jewish, the Judaized elite of this country, that are doing it for their benefit. They want the cheap labor. They want to put an end to any sort, any chance of whites having an ethno-state of our own.
Oh, yeah. It's the fast food lobby who's been putting a lot of money into this. Mark Zuckerberg, the Jew who runs Facebook, having hackathons with illegal aliens and them not getting arrested. Why weren't these illegal aliens who went to Congress detained, shipped out? I mean, it's ridiculous. And Obama has had to do a number of illegal things in order to help out these illegal aliens, such as the DREAM Act and various other executive orders that are intended to get it so that the actual people who are charged with enforcing the laws of the United States cannot enforce them. And so this is just it's pretty incredible. It's very telling. And his attorney general, Eric Holder, is involved in this as well, of course. This is the highest law enforcement official in the land. And he is, of course, shipping guns down to Mexico. This was Operation Fast and the Furious, and or was at least aware of it. And then they're making sure that their borders are porous and that these guns can come back into the United States, which they did. And Eric Holder was also on record after the whole Black Panther scandal, where they were outside of polling booths with billy clubs, and he actually dropped the charges against them. He was on record saying that pretty much he was doing this for, as he said, my people. He's quoted as saying, my people. So that goes to show that he identifies first with being black and American. Then that's not really what he's thinking about. His people are not the constituents, are not the American people, definitely not white people. It's black people. And when they want to make it seem like it's they're on the side of the illegals, then it's the illegals. Their people are anybody except for white people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, what's been happening is that when you have a white society and white society operates and is so peaceful and nice because it has this sort of inclusive attitude and this universalist attitude of having free speech and the law that applies equally to everyone and being welcoming to other people and not wanting to insult or turn away people in need, very Christian mentality, at least what Christians have been told is the Christian mentality, the way to believe. But at the same time, you've got these people that then move into these white societies and don't have that sort of universal attitude that everyone is my brother. They may play that game, they may use that kind of rhetoric to get what they want, but they actually have a much more particularist group identity and group interests in their minds. And that's what you see coming out when you hear these elected officials like Holder talking about my people or Obama. Obama's never run away from his blackness. And Mandela, if we get to him, likewise, he's never run away from his blackness. He's never expressed any sort of negative feelings about his blackness, to my knowledge. Yet every white person in any sort of position of leadership, it's almost de rigueur that they have to be self-deprecating, or maybe not self-deprecating, but race-deprecating. They have to be negative about whiteness. If they say anything at all about whiteness, it has to be to say something bad about whites.
Right. Yeah, that's
to remain in power.
Completely true. And the racial loyalty that Obama showed with Trayvon Martin was incredible. First, he said that that could have been his son. And then later, he said that could have been him 35 years ago. I believe it, though. I think Barack Obama probably was a drug-addled gangbanger. So
that's right. It could have been him. And he eventually became president of the United States. So what does that say about him? What does it say about the United States? It's done. Stick a fork in it. That's white people ought to get that straight in their minds, is that this idea about having a society in which, a peaceful rainbow, lollipops and happiness, unicorns everywhere, is diluted. And even if the blacks and all the rest were the Jews were all interested in creating it, it's not good for white people. It's a dystopian vision. It's not a utopian vision.
Well, that's basically what it has happened in South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa. I think we're living in post-apartheid America, and it hasn't gotten as bad here as it has gotten in South Africa. But the way that Obama and Mandela are almost melded together in Obama and Della, it's very telling. The way that all of our media on the right, on the left, everywhere in between, it seems, and all of the white countries are just hailing Mandela, who is an African communist, anti-white terrorist responsible for the genocide of the people of that country, the white people, and hell, the black people, some of them are much better off, but they're living in a country with incredible unemployment and all sorts of violence. I think that is what is happening, beginning to happen, in America as well. The unemployment's going up in black-run America. We have, if we're realistic about it, it's Jewish-run America with blacks as the puppets, the proxies that have been sent out against us. But it's very similar. And you look at Chicago, you look at Detroit, the kind of black-on-black violence that's happening there, it's astronomical. Yet none of these black leaders that seem to be so concerned about their black people, oh, we're fighting for my people, they don't care when black people are murdered by black people. That's not a good story for them. They're not actually in it for their people, as many are starting to understand. They're there just to basically incite hatred towards white people. So they're jump at any opportunity, even if it's a white Hispanic, apparently, to criticize for finally standing up to black thuggery.
Well, this thing that you're putting your finger on, this media adoration sanctifying people like Mandela, Obama, Martin Luther King, you know, the three of them all come to my mind as being very similar in that they're all ordinary people, you know, that they're not worth the adoration that they're given. And I think to myself, well, then what explains all this adoration? You know, that it's compensating for something. And I think it's the usual, it's one of the main tricks that that Jews use, is this inversion of reality. They're hiding the fact. Essentially, these guys are all bad for white people. That's what makes Martin Luther King, Mandela, and Obama heroes, is that they are symbolic of the loss of white prestige, the loss of white power, and the rise of black or non-white power. That's why they're famous. That's why they're made famous. That's why they're put up on a pedestal and to be celebrated, is because that's what you're celebrating when you celebrate any of those guys, is you're celebrating the downfall of whites.
No, it's about racial equality, Dan Stoffel. You don't seem to understand. It's about judging people based on the merit of their character, not the color of their skin. Wait, no, that's not it at all, because if your skin's white, you're going to get raped, you're going to get murdered, tortured, you're not going to get a job. That's what that actually represents. Equality means that they're going to take proactive measures to make sure that you are all brought down to the level of the blacks.
Yeah, if thinking about this, it's a good point. White people are the ones who tend to think it's about equality and think it's about giving people a fair shake and all of that. They've internalized this idea that, you know, white supremacy is a bad thing, Jim Crow and slavery and all of that, we should feel guilty about that. Let's just make a society for everyone where race doesn't matter, skin color doesn't matter. And the reality is, of course, there is, to make an excuse for white people, there is a little bit of that misleading indirection or misdirection in the rhetoric that the non-whites use, the Jews and other non-whites use to defraud us there. But if you pay close attention, not you can see it in the words, but you can also definitely see it in the actions of what comes out. The fruit of this tree is inequality. We've gone from a white supremacist system and a white supremacist way of thinking, white people have, to a non-white supremacist way of thinking and looking at the world, where we actually are encouraged to, and a lot of us do, engage in this celebration of non-whites because they're non-whites and because they symbolize that they're, you know, better than whites and whites suck.
They are, right? Haven't you heard about the new revised history? I'm not talking about revisionism, which we can get into in the second hour. I'm talking about how white people actually stole the brilliant inventions of the blacks. Even Al Sharpton, he gets this, right? He was quoted as saying, "White folks was in caves while we was building empires. We taught philosophy and astrology and mathematics before Socrates and them Greek homos ever got around to it." That was Al Sharpton. That was 1994 at King College that he said that. And he said a lot of amazing things over the years. And this is Eric Holder's good buddy there. So, yeah, we have to celebrate all of these great achievements of the ancient Afros. And, it's really what is being taught. It'd be funny if so many people didn't actually believe it.
Yeah, well, it's good and it's right to think good things about your own people. It's probably not a good thing to delude yourself and to make stuff up. Fortunately, white people don't really have to imagine that white people have done these amazing things throughout history because it is real. And we're not perfect either. We could talk about that a little bit further on, but our flaws. But yeah, I laugh at people like Sharpton.
So you know what I think is starting to happen. If it's not Jew fatigue that's going on right now, it's at least Negro fatigue. I think that even the white lemmings who watch TV, they're starting to get fed up. They're tired of glorifying Obama and Mandela and all of these other heroic Negroes that are thrown out to us while they see people that look like themselves being denigrated. And a good sign of this is that apparently the BBC has received over 1,300 complaints about the excessive coverage of Mandela's death. And so people were tired of seeing it on their television, especially because there was some severe weather there in the UK, and nobody was reporting on it because there was bigger news. This African communist terrorist genocidal maniac who sung songs about killing the white people, he had died. So we need to celebrate this man's life and mourn his death because he's such an amazing figure throughout the world. They might not have known really the facts about this guy, but I think it was just Negro fatigue. They're tired of being bombarded with these, great symbols of humanity who are obviously anti-white, as we've covered. He was about the taking down of the white establishment. And for viewers in Britain who are inundated by Muslims from Africa and all sorts of Asians and others,
yeah,
where they've lost their cities.
Well, that was my take on the Mandela thing. There's four presidents from the United States going, and I'm sure I don't watch the television all that much, and certainly not the network news anymore. But I'm sure there's similar fatigue in the United States too. My take on the day he died was that the point about Mandela being a symbol of handing over things, the white power. But the main thing is that Mandela is celebrated as a hero for being basically a nationalist, for being for his people. And the poster boy, the way I put it, was he's the Judaized globalist elite's poster boy for Africa for the Africans, take that turn of phrase from the white rabbit guys. And this idea of Africa for the Africans, you say Negro fatigue, but it could also be the intuition of people sitting in Britain flooded with foreigners and being told that, it's racist and makes you evil and stupid, crazy, and evil to, complain about your homeland being flooded by completely different aliens. And yet Africa is for the Africans, and Mandela is a hero because he got, South Africa for the black Africans. And
that's a great point.
Took it back from the whites. And, the point being that a minority you know, to use this dishonest Jewish terminology that they've used on us for decades now about majorities and minorities, the according to the Jewish narrative, the Jewish telling of these use of these words, majorities are illegitimate. Majorities should not rule for the simple fact that they're a majority, because they tend to abuse and oppress minorities, including the Jews. And the Jews are a minority. And for that reason, minorities are actually have more moral legitimacy than majorities do, except in Africa, of course, in South Africa, where it's the black majority that was the basis for their legitimacy, is that they're the native peoples of Africa and they are in the majority. And so this white minority that is ruling the country, that really built the country in reality and made it as wealthy and made it work as well as it was working, is illegitimate and rotten and needs to be replaced. You could use the same argument here with Jewish rule, that the Jews are in the vast minority in the United States, and yet they're at the very tippity top of the media and government and financial and educational structures here, and they shouldn't be, that the majority should just boot them out of power, as National Socialists did in Germany, and like the National Socialists in Greece are trying to do now.
Right, but when white people actually are forming majority and voting together, as the Golden Dawn is doing, as other nationalist parties in Europe are starting to do, then democracy isn't the greatest thing that we need to
That's
go fight wars over, because then it becomes like neo-Nazis and
That's
racist
right.
and hateful. So in those instances, we're going to have to go to Jewish authoritarianism and forget about Jewish democracy.
That's right. Yeah, the thing to keep in mind is the democracy that they hold up, and even democracy, I think, historically, is really just a plutocracy in the wings or in reality, that it's a small cabal of wealthy, powerful people who are actually ruling. And to use our current contemporary example as the example I'm really talking about, because the United States is always presented as the example of democracy that we have to bomb other people in the world to deliver this model to. The way it works in the United States is we have our elections, and we like to pat ourselves on the back for voting, and we put a lot of energy into these two faces of the same power structure, the Republicans and the Democrat Party, and anybody else is wasting their vote if they vote any other way. But it's a charade, it's a game, it's a circus or a kabuki theater to just keep us distracted and keep us busy. Even though the votes, I think, are for the most part real, and you know there's rigging going on, and all sorts of other distortions and gerrymandering and so forth. But even though it's real, it is easy to manipulate using the media, because the masses are easily swayed against this guy because, hey, he's a little bit kooky, he's a little bit crazy. You don't want to elect him. He's, you know, I've heard he's a racist. Versus their hero, you know, Obama, who right now they want him, and you know, when the time comes, they won't have to elect. They won't be able to elect Obama according to the rules again. But you know, when they want to get rid of him, they'll be able to say negative things about him, and they'll present their other guy. You know, it's a frickin' frack Tweedledum Tweedledee thing, where the other guy to be selected that you're given a choice of will also work for them, just in a different suit or something. It's
a charade. Another way that democracy has been shown to be illegitimate when people vote with nationalist sentiment, it would be with the EU, in particular Ireland, who rejected it twice through a real democracy, which is its people voting on the matter, before they basically launched a massive campaign and probably did some backroom dealings and vote rigging to get the EU, I think this was the Lisbon Treaty, passed in Ireland for the third try. It actually happened, and then they joined the EU, which has a non-democratically elected leader, which tells their countries how they need to behave, what kind of immigrants they need to let in, and what they're doing with their finances. So, quite interesting how they love to promote this Jewish democracy, but when it doesn't work for them, or when it's more convenient, they're going to be installing their Jewish authoritarian system.
Yeah, and I agree. The point that Kevin MacDonald often brings up is to point at the Bolshevist revolution in the Soviet Union and the deadly consequences there, that the Jews who were behind that revolution and whatever extent that they participated, which was a big extent, they used the power once they achieved it to liquidate millions of people, and did it with brutal means. So, and this is what ultimately what they will do in any country where their power is seriously threatened.
Well, Tanstoffel, do you want to take a short break here? We'll go to some music, come back for the second hour, take some calls, and get into a few different subjects.
Sure thing. I'll see you in 5 minutes.
All right, so I'm going to actually go to what you have as your intro music. I'm not seeing it right now. Maybe actually let's conclude our discussion real quickly here regarding Nelson Mandela and the situation in South Africa while I upload this track. And, I mean, if people want to research this, they can get into the likely 3,000 victims of the Winnie Mandela necklace. That's really an eye-opener there when you understand what she was doing while her husband was imprisoned, and how she's held up as some kind of hero here in the West. Actually, she was in the White House. So a negress who puts tires around people and then lights them on fire, well, they're gas-soaked tires, and tortures them, that's somebody to be celebrated. This is... Ooh, it's scary. Yeah. And then when you consider all the people that have died just in South Africa after apartheid ended, and how it's nothing's being done about it by the police and they're given no protection, it's just disgusting to see these people celebrated.
Yeah. Well, it's who whom. It all depends who's doing what to whom to judge whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
And, well, of course, the Jews are very much behind the happenings in South Africa, in particular, Joe Slovo, the Jew from, I believe he was from a city in Russia, was down there in South Africa with Nelson Mandela planning their terrorist activities, and he was with him many decades later when Nelson Mandela finally came to power after he stopped being a terrorist, according to the United States, and instead a hero. Amazing how sometimes terrorists then become the heroes. The same thing happened, of course, with the Syrian rebels. When the Syrian rebels were allied with Al-Qaeda fighters, and these are the people we're supposed to be funding and giving weapons to, then they're part of a heroic cause, not terrorists.
That's right. Whether you're a terrorist or a freedom fighter depends on your point of view. It depends on the point of view of the person who's using that label one way or the other. And it was more, of course, than Joe Slovo in South Africa. I know you're aware of that, but it was just a swarm of Jews that were involved there and in other countries in Africa. It's fair to say that without the Jewish involvement, and I think the Jews themselves say this, it wouldn't have happened.
I wonder when Robert Mugabe is going to be hailed as the next great hero of the white world for all his amazing things that he did in order to end white dominance.
Yeah, I think in his case, it's a little bit of a hard sell, at least right now. Maybe another decade or two, maybe after he dies, they can rehabilitate him, or they'll try. But for the moment, at least they're trying the old no news is good news when it comes to him.
All right. I have the song ready now, so we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Okay.
By the hand, saying someday you'll know. some beer. Oh, there were many things I didn't know. Your son was born to me. Mama held his hand, saying someday you'll understand.
Welcome back to the Blitzkrieg broadcast. This is Kyle Hunt here with you, December 9th, 2013. My guest is Tan Stoffel from the White Network, and his show is Age of Treason Radio. When are you going to start doing podcasts again?
Well, there should be one tomorrow night. I just recorded it, and it's the first break I took in a long time from the start. I took off 2 weeks because I had some other stuff going on besides Thanksgiving, a bit of a road trip with the family, and so I really, needed to take a break. But it was good. I got my batteries recharged, and I'm coming back with a whole new topic to talk about into the new year.
All right, great. So we have a few more controversial things to discuss here in the second hour. Things that have been, somewhat exploding in the alternative media, or at least our section of it recently, and it involves this network and your own as well. There was something of a storm after I had Mark Weber on my show, Mark Weber of the IHR. I wasn't really aware of the various people who do not really like Mark Weber and what he has done with the IHR, in particular Carolyn Yeager, who is on the White Network. And afterwards, she did a show and an article calling for him to resign from the IHR and giving a number of reasons why. And Mark was recently on with one of our hosts, Dana, as well. So it's something that a lot of people have been talking about. Other shows were done about these shows and articles written, and I even saw it over at metapedia.org, how Mark Weber was being called out. Do you have any thoughts to offer on that particular situation while I have you here?
Yeah, sure. First of all, of course, I'm not Carolyn Yeager. I'm Tan Stoffel. I'm a separate person. We're not joined at the hip. But I started the White Network with Carolyn, and I was the technical guy who made it happen. And I did it because I wanted to enable her to do what she does. I had enjoyed her work at Voice of Reason Radio in the previous two, maybe almost 3 years that she had been working with them. And I had been a guest with her, and I think she was moving away from her particular focus on Holocaust history and World War II history toward more of a racial understanding of things. And I was moving in the opposite direction, that I had I thought thoroughly understood race and the Jews, and was starting to come to terms with the Holocaust. And I found her way of dealing with it, the detailed kind of skeptical arguments that she would make about it, very appealing and very convincing, and very calm and reasonable in her presentation of it. And so she told me that she had wanted to leave Voice of Reason. There were a lot of reasons that she was unhappy about. We've done a couple of programs in the past where we talk a little bit about that. But I did my part, was to, you know, make a new platform so that she could continue to do radio shows and be free to talk about what she wants to talk about. And she's made since then a bit of a change in the way she, what she does, and the subjects that she focuses on. But she's stuck with the Holocaust history. And Mark Weber, I think, is someone that she probably has been critical of for a long time, even back at Voice of Reason, even when he had a show right alongside her on that network. And, you know, it's because neither one of them really could control whether the other one had a show. And that was maybe part of the reason why Carolyn didn't want to be part of Voice of Reason anymore, was that program and other programs she thought were not not the right way to go about things. You know, let's put it this way. The Voice of Reason, the idea was, let's take some hard-hitting, hardcore, no-nonsense stuff like Carolyn Yeager's show, and let's mix it with some lighter fare to appeal to a broader audience. And hopefully when that broader audience comes into those shows, they will then go look for other shows on the same network and discover Carolyn Yeager and her her message. Carolyn doesn't care for that approach. I don't care for that approach either. I agreed with her on that point. And I didn't like the fact that Voice of Reason, like her, I didn't like the fact that it was sort of slyly pro-white. It was run by somebody who was pro-white and had that kind of an attitude behind the scenes, but it was not explicitly pro-white. We both, so that's why the White Network is called the White Network. And we made it very clear that white doesn't mean Jew, that Jews are excluded, because in order for white people to discuss our interests in a sane and effective way, we have to exclude these people who, like Jews, who are just going to make trouble for that discussion, try and derail it and distract it and so forth. Now, back to Mark Weber, you know, all along with the White Network, Carolyn has done her own thing and has created controversy by being critical of other people. And, you know, that's her thing. You know, when I listen to Carolyn do her programs, I find myself agreeing with her criticisms. You know, if not in everything that she says, I see that she's generally right about what she has to say, the opinions that she offers. Sometimes she doesn't always have the best evidence or evidence that I would present. I would look for something different. She's more driven by her feelings and her emotions, and I'm more driven by logic and reason and facts and statistics, things like that. So we take a different approach at things. But I trust her opinion about things. I trust her judgment about things. And I think she goes about it in a way that's different than me, and I don't join in. If I felt all that strong about Mark Weber, I would, you know, jump in, but I don't. I don't really have a strong opinion about Mark Weber. I don't have a strong feeling about the Holocaust. You know, she thinks it's very, very important, and she's getting into those details. To make it an analogy, it's like 9/11. You know, a lot of people get into 9/11, and they get up to their elbows in all of the details, and they want to know everything. And a lot of the people who do that say, you know, the Jews did 9/11, and they're utterly convinced of that. And if you don't agree with them on every point, every little issue about 9/11, they start getting upset with you, and they start calling you a shill or whatever, you know, saying I don't trust anybody who doesn't say that the Jews did 9/11. And, you know, the Holocaust, the 9/11, these big things that people, even the Jews themselves, I can understand why somebody would look at me and not want to accept what I say. But calling them stupid or something, I just sort of shrug my shoulders. At some point, some of what I say, I hope will stick in their minds. But to bring it back to the Holocaust, I think Carolyn's on the right track. I think Mark Weber, she's made the case, and I agree with it, has basically become an obstacle at the IHR. I trust her take on that and the other Holocaust revisionists that she cites as having this opinion. And now I think in your defense that when she is critical of you, I think that that's she's going a bit far there. I think that her hostility, her negative feelings about Mark Weber's work or lack of work, whatever, his being an obstacle, is being enabled a bit by you having him on to talk, that you're exposing people to Mark Weber's sort of soft version of the Holocaust that she doesn't think is good and right. It's not technically accurate, and it's not good for us to be promoting that kind of a watered-down approach to dealing with the Holocaust, and that you're enabling it, and so therefore you're a bad person too. You know, at the very least you're ignorant, and at the worst you're aiding and abetting, you know, not to put words in her mouth. I hesitate to even talk about this because this is basically Carolyn's thing. It's her thing about Mark Weber, and to the extent that she wants to make it a criticism of you too, that's her criticism for her to make of you. It's not for me to get involved in it, except to express my support for Carolyn generally and give my take on it. That's my take.
Well,
but I'm here talking to you, so I think you are valuable. And you do good work, so from what I've heard of what you do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and I enjoy your programs as well. With the Mark Weber situation, I should be having him on next week, so hopefully we'll be able to discuss some of these issues and perhaps field some calls to get some of the points made by his detractors, because it is an important subject to many people. I hear what you're saying about the Holocaust and 9/11 not necessarily being all that important to your focus right now, and it isn't all that important to some people that listen to Renegade. Other people want to keep pushing these issues and think that we really need to go in depth on them. At a certain point, when I realize something's bogus, I don't really care to get into the nitty-gritty, and that's why I get really annoyed with the whole, you know, planes or no planes debate about September 11th, and just spending all of this time dealing with the way I see it, minutia, or in some instances just being overly critical of people within the movement. And I think that there is a place for it. We all need to be able to take criticism and respond to it. But what often happens within the white nationalist community, the anti-Jewish community, whatever you know, group it is, actually, if it's going against the system and legitimately trying to oppose it, it seems that oftentimes it is broken up into discord and unable to function properly because it becomes, as we've termed it a few times, a circular firing squad. So instead of actually pointing the weapons at the enemy, you're always just focused on each other. And I don't want to see that happen. I would like to definitely get to the bottom of who could be shills, who could be misleading, who is not doing a good enough job. I think that it's important that the best and the most honest and the most powerful rise to the top of what we're doing. That is for sure. But I always want to keep my focus on how we can improve ourselves and also what the enemy is doing to us. And I don't spend a whole lot of time when I have a guest on researching his or her detractors.
Why you have the guest on, to talk about their particular hobby horse and hear from them directly. You can't be expected to know all the details about the person you have on. I wouldn't expect you to answer to people who are critical of you because of some position I've taken, just because you had me on to talk on your show. You couldn't know all the details about everybody you interview.
No, because we have such limited time in our days often, and there's so much that's out there. You know, it's really hard to keep track of everything and listen to every single program that's been done by somebody or read every single one of their articles. It's a very daunting task sometimes to try to really understand what somebody's about. And as you're saying, that's what the interview is for, because you get to talk to them in person, ask them questions, and have them respond. As you were saying before, it's often this guilt by association that happens, though. And and of course, if there's a repeated pattern of having either Jews on your show or very suspect people, then people should be a little bit wary. But if it's certain people don't like them, so then you can't trust the host anymore because they had a guest you don't like on, I think that's just it's taking a little bit too far. And earlier tonight, there was some anonymous chatter in there who was bringing up your wife, who is half Ashkenazi Jew, and basically, I think, trying to say that this discredits you and what you're doing, and also, I think, implying that this was something that you were trying to keep secret, when, in fact, that is not the case. You had told me in our conversation last week over Skype that you gave me the full disclosure about this and said you'd be willing to talk about it. You've exposed this yourself, and so this is just the kind of trouble starting that I see that always seems to take place, especially by anonymous people in chat rooms. And perhaps, you know, this is something that people should be aware of, but it's not that you were trying to conceal this information in any way. So there wasn't a nefarious aspect to, oh, Kyle's having on Tan Stoffel, who has a half-Jewish wife, which he keeps secret, and that means he's got a nefarious agenda. Why not try to hear it from the person themselves, look into their own works, and instead listen to what they're saying and judge that. But please respond.
Yeah. So a couple of things. The word nefarious comes to mind. Just to go rewind back to what we were talking about. I don't think that the people who have these hobby horses, whether it's or these favorite subjects that they've invested a lot of time in, that they're motives are nefarious. It's just that they have invested a lot of time, and they see it as very important to, for instance, get people to realize what they now realize about the Holocaust or 9/11 or whatever they're, in my case, it's the Jews, which is what's ironic about this issue of my wife's father being an Ashkenazi Jew, which I disclosed as soon as the problem is that I did understand that it was a problem for a while before I disclosed it. It was, I don't know, you know, about mid-2007 or towards the end of 2007 that I really woke up as a white man and thought, you know, race is important and I'm going to embrace it instead of running away from it from now on. And it was very shortly after that, I think it was the end of 2007, that I realized the Jews are the enemy of the white race. And of course, my first thought was, well, how do I deal with this fact? My wife's father was a Jew. I never met him, but I've met other family members of hers on that side. And of course, you know, in my life, I've also met other Jews that I'm not married to or in-laws with, and generally had okay experiences with. I mean, there's certain things that now occur to me now that I know how Jews are, that I look at it in a different light. But it did take me some time to think to myself, how do I deal with this? And the first way I dealt with it is, at least publicly, I did not shy away from the Jewish question just because my wife's father's Jewish. The minute, or at least up until that point in my life, I had, like most people do, even the people who aren't married to people whose fathers are Jewish, I shied away from it. And I admit that. No excuses, but once I did realize, I started to grapple with it. I did not let it shy me away from continuing to talk about race and even the Jews and being critical of Jews. I started off with this, as you can go back and read from that article on, in 2007, time. My criticisms of the Jews were kind of weak and kind of, you know, squishy. And I look back at that now and I feel, you know, terrible that I argued in that way. But over time, I came to understand it even more and more. And by the time I made that disclosure in 2010, I realized this is a critical issue. This is even for a guy who's anonymous on the internet. As I meet people in real life, as I become more and more friends with people who are racially aware, this is just a reality that I've got to deal with. And I, it's the other thing that I was thinking is it's important to me when I read somebody, somebody's ideas, as much as I like to say, it's about the ideas, man, it's not about the person who's spouting them. Well, that's an ideal, but it's not the reality is that it is important who's saying what an idea is. It is important what their life situation is, what their history is. I want to know about people whose ideas I start playing with. I want to know where they're coming from. I want to know what their motivation is. And I think it's clear from reading the things that I've written, and I hope it's clear because this is my intent, it's clear in my heart, that I'm not trying to make excuses for the Jews. I'm not trying to make a space in white nationalism or pro-white activism for people, for Jews or for half-Jews or even for people who are married to half-Jews. I'm just trying to share what I'm coming to understand about race and even the stuff that I'm coming to understand about Jews. In fact, since that time, since the 2010 and even 2007, I've been digging at this white, what I think of as the white Jewish fault line, you know, this pretense that Jews are white, that 99% of white people fall for, and digging at it, trying to figure out, well, why do white people think this? Why? And pulling it apart, trying to defuse it, trying to understand it so that it can be stopped, because I care for the white race. I care for my larger group, even though that may seem like it's certainly abnormal, that it seems like the norm for a guy who wakes up and realizes race is real. Like, let's take Alex Jones as an example of somebody who realizes there's something wrong in the world and talks about it all the time and created a radio network. And yet he had a disclosure of his own a little earlier this year about how his wife is Jewish. And his reaction is more the typical reaction of people who have this problem, this issue, and then how they deal with it. And the way he deals with it is he blames the Nazis. He doesn't blame the Jews for what's going on. Oh, no, it's not just the Jews. Yeah, there's some Jewish gangsters or Jewish criminal organizations. But, you know, the real problem, you know what the real problem is? It's the Nazis. And by the Nazis, he means of course, the regime that's been gone for 70 years, but he's talking now today of the people who call him and heckle him. Like, for instance, the guy who's the anonymous commenter in the chat that you're talking about. I'm not offended by people like that. I'm not put off by people like that. I don't even blame people like that, assuming he's sincere, assuming he's just got a very pure idea of what white is, and what's best for whites, more power to them. I actually agree with them. Well, I think that the Jews need to be excluded, even to the point of excluding people like me.
Well, I think that it's great that you say that. And what I was trying to get at before with judging people by what they say, not just by some incidents of their of their past or their personal life, basically – within our current movement, there are a number of people who could be considered less than perfect in terms of you know, what they might have done before they were aware of these issues, what kind of baggage that might entail, all sorts of things, even just their vices. There's a lot that pro-white people might not be completely proud about, and so if some of them are willing to talk about that, be out there in the open about it, and still trying to do their job to the best of their abilities, I think that that's good, and we should not exclude necessarily these people right off the bat because they could have a whole lot of valuable things to offer, because we don't have all of that many people fighting on our side right now. I think it's especially important to have something of a big tent philosophy. But as you said, Jews should not be included in that. And I think that when Jared Taylor says, they look white to me, they look white to me, I think that is obviously the wrong approach to take, because as soon as Jews get in there, they hijack the agenda. They make it really about being pro-Jewish and always combating the potential for anti-Semitism. And so you really do have to question what somebody's motives are if you find out that there are some elements of their personal life that are connected to Judaism.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what it is the argument, the same argument that you're using to say that there are, you know, we don't want to divide our movement, and we don't want to be too picky because, you know, basically everybody has some sort of skeleton in the closet, is the same argument, the same sort of arguments that can be used to say, hey, we should include these Jews. After all, they're so capable and they bring bags of money with them. And, you know, then we won't get such bad coverage from the press. It's a bad argument ultimately. And also the argument about numbers and about big tent, I don't think that that's the right way to go, to be so tolerant that that we include people in this, our movement, that I don't even like to use that term because it's too vague. It's the problem with the voice of reason or other people that aren't really doing our thing, that don't really share our interests, don't share our goal. Well, and that's why it's important to get to the basics of what it is, what is at the root. And I think what's at the root of any identity, it's about identity, it's about a racial identity. Who is us is the first question, and what's best for us? And in this case, it's white people. And that's, if there's somebody who's like questioning 9/11 or questioning the Holocaust or questioning Israel, questioning the Jews, if they aren't about the 14 words and doing what's best for the white race, then they're not part of us. They're not part of our movement. And
no, I agree with you completely there. Yet I see that there's still an opportunity to have other people advocating for us. For instance, earlier today I saw a video of an Asian man, I think living in an Asian country. And what he was talking about for 10 minutes was how people need to help white people, or rather that white people need to help themselves. And they have to stop being so kind to all these immigrants. And he doesn't want to see white people vanish from the earth. And basically, he was coming out and giving the pro-white argument as an Asian person. You know, he's not going to be a leader of any movement or be included in the white nationalist movement, but he is offering pretty good propaganda for us to pick up and use. And so when there are people out there who might have this baggage or might have skeletons in their closet, yet they're still producing good information that we can perhaps pick up and use for our cause, then I think it should be done. We need to take the best of everything that's around, and sometimes that's coming through flawed individuals, perhaps.
I agree. I do what I do. I try to learn and understand, and then I share it via podcasts and via blogs. And I wouldn't listen to somebody who told me I should just stop doing what I'm doing because I'm in a compromised situation. But at the same time, it's not right to put somebody like me in a position of authority or a position of leadership. It's not, and this is something that you see a lot with pure Jews, where people who are pro-white and racialists, at least when they're first starting out, they think to themselves, because the signals are all there from the society around them, since you're not, you know, you shouldn't say bad things about Jews, they think if they want to say bad things about Jews, well, let me just quote a Jew saying bad things about Jews. That way, I'm not saying it, and it's not a white person saying it. It's got to be valid, and it's harder to criticize if it's coming from a Jew. And they do this search for the good Jews. They're looking for good Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ultimately, it's a waste of time. It's negative. It's a sign of just how poisoned our minds are, that anybody even engages in it.
I think they put out good Jews as well. They put out those examples within the alternative media, within the more mainstream media, whether it's, a Noam Chomsky or a Norman Finkelstein. Jews who are critical of Jews, Jews against Zionism. They want us to associate with these, good Jews, or even if it's Brother Nathaniel Kapner. A lot of people would use the same arguments I gave before in regard to Brother Nathaniel Kapner, and perhaps in some ways, maybe that would be a valid argument, because if you can take examples from his videos, how he's able to be successful and present the material and do it yourself, take that material, repackage it, and put it out coming from somebody who's not a
former
Jew, as he considers himself.
You have to remove the clown getup that he's got. That's the problem with Kapner. There's two problems with him. He is flamboyantly kooky looking in his delivery that makes any sane person kind of think that whatever he's saying is strange. But the other thing is, if you pay close attention to what he's saying, he wants white people to simply reassert ourselves and take control back of our societies so that we can all live in peace and happiness again, like it used to be, where the Jews just did their thing without destroying society. He's not facing the fact, because he's a Jew, that the best thing for white people to do is to get rid of Jews, to eject Jews from our societies, because they're nothing but parasites, and we don't need them. Whites don't need Jews. We shouldn't just be trying to reset our society back to a place where we're all comfortable together. That's the main problem that white people have, is this idea that we have some obligation to make a society in which everybody feels comfortable. The only way that white people are going to survive is to change their attitude and make a society in which only white people are even the object of pleasing. And that's the benchmark for society.
Well, we have a few callers on the line. I saw one dropped earlier. So if they want to call back in, please do. The number is 347-633-9657. I said we were going to take calls. So if you do call back in, I'll be sure to take it. We have Jim, who seems to have been waiting for quite some time now. Jim, welcome to the show. Any questions or comments for Tan Stoffel here?
Yeah, as far as Mark Weber goes, I think Carol Yeager is right in her criticism of Mark Weber, but not she's wrong in her criticizing of you, because I think you're the best talk show host on the net. I mean, you're always fair to everybody. You always give, even though you might not agree with them, you always give them a chance to say whether you don't attack them, and so she's wrong there.
But, well, thanks, Jim. But she did give me some compliments as well, and did link to the show, so is drawing attention to myself, my shows, and also to Mark Weber. Though Mark Weber has been in the spotlight more now than he has been in quite a few years, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, on Wednesday, you know, I talked to him and I asked him about the he gave me the exact number of Jews that died during the Holocaust. I would say, and he was very evasive. You know, he wouldn't give me a direct answer. And then I asked him about the gas chambers, and he said there was actually some gas chambers in Poland, and I don't, that is not true, because he said David Irving told him that. Now I talked to David Irving, and this was about 15 years ago or so in Washington D.C. And he told me that there were no gas chambers in any of the camps operated by the Germans. And he did say something about there was some gassings on the Eastern Front to use gas vans. I don't know about that, but that's what he said. Of course, but I mean, the thing is, the man's evasive, and I have a problem with that. I mean, there was all this controversy with him and Willis Carto, you know, years ago. So I don't know, you know. But anyway, getting back to the Jewish question. So I've been I'm a student of astrology for quite a few years, and I know I went to like in your chart, you know, like trines are always planets. You have planets 120 degrees apart. That's a trine. That's a good aspect. If you have squares, that's 90 degrees, and that's a difficult aspect. Now I remember I talked to astrologers. Gee, I don't like my squares. I wish I had a chart with all trines. He said, well, if you had a chart with all trines, you wouldn't grow. You'd just be very. I mean, it's the squares that make you grow. That's because the oppositions and squares in opposition. Now, if we didn't have the Jews to oppose us and to give us a hard time, we wouldn't grow. So actually, the Jew is necessary for the evolution of our race and for humanity as a whole. I mean, that's why the Jews are there. So, I mean, I think the whole thing about the Jewish is we have to resist them, but we shouldn't hate them, because actually, no. If it wasn't for them, we would never grow.
Jim, I don't know if that necessarily is true. I'm going to let Tan Stoffel answer it, but what I'd like to do is offer a metaphor or analogy here. A dog would be much healthier without having a bunch of ticks or leeches on it. I don't think that those ticks or leeches could be said to make that dog grow. I understand what you're saying about having a strong adversary or a strong opponent in a game, any kind of physical or mental competition. Yes, that does help you up your own game and become better for it, but I see the Jews not as really opponents, but just as a parasitical entity that has latched on to us, the host.
We've allowed them to latch. I mean, we wouldn't have had to. I mean, the Jew operates through hypnosis and through the power of suggestion. I mean, we gave our power willingly away to the Jews, and they took our power.
But it doesn't make us better because we're hypnotized and lethargic and obese these days. I don't think that's making us better or stronger. Yes, perhaps a few of us who have seen what's going on and are fighting against it. But Tan Stoffel, what are your thoughts on the matter?
The Jews are parasitic in nature. That's the bottom line. And I think that for two reasons. I think just objectively looking at it, it's a loss of fitness, not a – they aren't helping the white race in any way. The white race is diseased and dying, and a lot of people make that comment without even understanding anything about the Jews or talking about the Jews. Well, I'd say that the explanation for the white race doing the sort of pathological things that it's doing is that it's been it's got pathology, and the pathogen is the Jews. The loss of fitness. I mean, when you look at the biological definition of parasitism, the virulence of a parasite can actually be measured in the damage it does. And if you honestly account for the damage created by the various frauds of the Jews on whites, it's astronomical, the cost. They care about themselves. They don't care about us. They don't see whites as their equivalent or a race that they're co-evolving with, as equals, as adversaries, but sort of equals that they need. They don't see us as something that they need. They see us as a host to be used, abused, exploited to whatever extent that they can, and they don't let up. As their host starts to die, they just start thinking about where they can flee to next.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're making arrangements to transfer their power and wealth and industries, or at least their controls over these things, to China and elsewhere.
But again, this is a parasite cannot attack a healthy organism. It's only a diseased organism that can attack.
Oh, no, it can. So
that's not true.
Oh, yeah, it can.
Yeah,
well, anyway,
to a certain extent, they can be co-evolved. But the thing to keep in mind is that they are two separate organisms. If it evolves to the point where they need each other, it's not really parasitism anymore. It's some form of mutual existence.
Symbiosis.
And with the Jews, it's not mutual. Whites could live without Jews. We might be bland and boring. That's the Jewish. That's the excuse that Jews use to justify their existence. Is you need us. Who would be your bankers? Who would make your movies? Well, as if we need those things. The truth is, whites don't need the Jews. The truth is exactly the opposite. Jews need a host to live. If they didn't have a host, they would tear themselves apart. Can you imagine what kind of a world, the brief world it would be if it was populated purely by Jews?
Oh, yeah. It would be a world full of vampires. They wouldn't last long. Jim, I think a good thing to think about here as well is whether or not the white people of this world, the Europeans, were better off because of World War II, because, you know, they had these strong adversaries. They were warring with each other, competing with each other. Whether or not they came out of that more advanced, stronger because of it. No, I think they were incredibly weakened. This was the Jewish plot the whole entire time, was to kill off tens and tens of millions and weaken us to the point that we wouldn't be able to resist their further imposition of their will.
We listened to them. We wouldn't have had to listen to them, but we did. There's no, the Jews have, the only way the Jews can make us do their bidding is through the power of suggestion, and we buy into their lies. If we would realize that the Jews were lying, they would have no effect on us. That's the whole thing. The Jews don't have any real power. We give them all the power that they have.
They have real power now.
I agree with that. An awareness to a fraud, of course, undoes the fraud. And then from that point on, once a person's alerted to a fraud that they're being that's being perpetrated against them, the onus is on them to put an end to the fraud, to stop participating in it. I agree with that. But I would say that for the most part, whites don't understand the Jews in that fashion. They don't understand that they're being defrauded by the Jews. And that is another sign of a parasite, is this disguise and the lying and the manipulative attitude that the Jews have. They manipulate us and they disguise themselves, because that's what a parasite does when it's trying to exploit its host. It injects the host with all sorts of chemicals that disarm and disable the host, sing soothing songs to the host to distract them and to tell them everything's okay, you need us. You know, that's part of the poison.
Yeah, Jim. Thank you for calling in, Jim. But we've got a few more calls.
I think about 140, and that's what it is. See, they've been through eugenics. I mean, they've been haggling and everything all these years. They've developed this ability to tell people anything, any lie, and they seem to believe it. That's why our task is to wake people up and tell them about
this. So let's make white people aware of that history, that ability, and let's put an end to it. We don't have to just cordon them off and play nice with them.
Right.
Or the idea of the solution to the Jewish problem back 100 years ago was they need their own country to live in so that they could become like any other normal ethnicity. Well, they got that now. They don't have that excuse anymore, and they're still this horrible, harmful entity when they live amongst other people, and they still insist on living amongst other people. So what's the next solution?
Jim, I'm going to have to go to the next callers here because we're running out of time. We've got a few more on the board here.
Okay.
Thank you for calling in.
And I really enjoy your podcast, The Age of Trees. I listen every week, and I've learned a lot of good things from your podcast. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
All right. That was Jim, called in to the last Mark Weber show and gave him a hard time about the gas chambers. So maybe he'll be calling into my show as well. We'll see. We've got the next caller here. Welcome to the show. Who is this?
Hey, this is Miller.
Yes.
Oh, hey, this is Hank. I'm just calling in. I like everything y'all are talking about, Dan. I think what kind of needs to be discussed more than anything, I think in particular kind of the Jewish question is getting pretty well understood, and it seems there's a lot of consensus. I think the more important thing is trying to figure out what we're doing going forward, because, I mean, like you so honestly mentioned that your wife's half Jewish and everything, and to me, we just have to kind of wonder is that, you know, like at least especially in the American perspective, that, I mean, like non-Orthodox Jewish intermarriage rates are 78%. And, I mean, I've had a lot of acquaintance in my life where I've met all these people who are, you know, like a fourth Jewish or half Jewish maybe. And, I mean, it's kind of run the gamut where I'm amazed to see somebody who's only a fourth Jewish but will have like a really strange kind of weird attachment to the identity, even though they've never really had any semblance of like a Jewish childhood or, you know, grown-up adulthood or anything like that. But
they're
at the
grasping anything, though. They're grasping at anything because they don't have a white identity, right? They don't have anything.
That's why I see it, yeah.
No, but I agree with Hank. It's worse than, say, one-quarter Negro. Somebody who's one-quarter Negro wants to forget that they're one-quarter Negro, whereas somebody who's one-quarter Jewish wants to pull that out and make that their identity. They want to be Jewish. That's the nature of it. And, they're interbreeding with the host society, part of the mechanism by which the Jews do what they do. That's part of the biochemical technique that they use to invade their host. But it's a one-way gene flow out of the core. The Orthodox Jews are the core of the Jews, and they really don't mix. They don't even want to mix with the assimilated Jews, the non-Orthodox Jews. They don't want to marry them and have children with them. So there's this one-way flow of Jewish genes into the host around them. And what it does is it softens the host. It causes the host to want to be tolerant And that's the wrong thing for white people. If there's one main flaw that white people have been guilty of for the last 2,000 years, it's being too open and too accepting to this siren song, this poison that comes mainly from the Jews to serve the best interests of Jews, of tolerance and you know, all of that.
Well,
tolerating the Jew, that's what it serves.
Well,
that's
true, but I'd agree with you on their you know, motivations as to why they're doing this, or why some quarter Jews will associate with being Jewish. I do think that the quarter Negroes and the half Negroes would prefer to associate with being Negro when it suits them, such as Barack Obama or any of these other Negroes that are half Negroes that are paraded around on television, because whites are hated so much in this society. Hank, yes.
True. Yeah, I was just saying, I wanted to say the problem with the Negro comparison, though, is that, you know, Negroes' genes are just so strong that,
yeah,
you know, you're really pulling strings if you're, even if you're, you know, an eighth, there's still usually very noticeable differences. But
Jews
I wanted to
go back
to that. Yeah, but the problem, I'm saying the problem is coming in the future, like especially with the United States. I mean, we could have the situation. I mean, white nationalism, we want to be a mass movement, which means that from the membership-wise, you know, and there's plenty of people who have white skin, maybe half-Jewish, quarter-Jewish background, and, you know, they could be, by growing up for whatever reason, they might not think of themselves Jewish in any kind of way, and maybe they've grown up in Atlanta or some crap black neighborhood, and they see themselves as white, and we can hopefully make them see themselves as white versus, say, somebody who's a quarter Jewish but has grown up their whole damn life watching Schindler's List and, you know, my maternal grandparent or whatever was a Holocaust survivor. And I just wonder how we should deal with that. Is it just best to be super hardcore about it just in case, just as the safest strategy? Or?
Yes, I think the Nuremberg laws were more than reasonable. Maybe not reasonable enough. I would advise a one-drop rule myself. I think that, you know, trying to detach myself emotionally from what does this mean for me and my family, what does it mean for the white race? I think a one-drop rule is the way it ought to be.
We had this in our notes tonight to discuss. Well, we didn't get around to it yet, but Dan Stoffel and I did want to discuss who should be allowed to serve in any future kind of government. We were considering what the Third Reich did. They had a lot of half-Jews or quarter-Jews serving in the military and other functions within Germany. They identified themselves as Germans first before Jews, apparently. Perhaps some of them were subversive, who knows, but they had a different situation than us, definitely. But it's something that we definitely do need to think about. And there are a lot of self-hating Jews out there who don't like being Jews, and they'd much prefer to associate with the white people that they've grown up around. So I think especially if we are successful, we'll have to deal with this issue more and more as people would like to join our movement and be part of something that's up and coming. I think Jews serving in our future system, I put a maybe on it. I don't mean Jews, half Jews, quarter Jews, people who don't want to identify themselves as Jews at all. But leading in that system, definitely not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. How the National Socialists do it? Was it that they just hold, say, half Jews at a really higher standard usually to prove that they were loyal to the German state?
Half Jews, as I understand it, half Jews were excluded from positions of authority or power. Quarter Jews were not, but there were limits on half Jews on who they could marry. They could not marry other half Jews. I'm not clear on the details, but there were marriage restrictions as well that made sense as far as trying to prevent Jews from just breeding with other. If half Jews breed with other half Jews, well, what do they produce? They produce half Jews. You know, they're still half Jews, and so they're perpetuating. The goal of the Nuremberg Laws was to separate, to tease apart the two races so that the Jews would be Jews and the Germans would be Germans, with the end goal of expelling the Jews from Germany. First from the positions of power, making them unwelcome, and ultimately removing Jews from the living space of Germans so that the Germans could live free and clear of the parasitic influence of the Jews.
Hey, Hank, I appreciate you calling in. Now, we've got two more callers to get to in the archives here. I don't want to keep Tan Stoffel too much longer, but thanks for the call. Do appreciate it, and good topic.
You too. Thank you. See
you. Yeah, another point. Hank can listen to this offline, I guess. But Jewish identity, it's one of the topics I explored in pretty good detail this last year. There is a component that's ideological, you know, Jews teaching their young what it means to be a Jew. But there's a biological component as well. And when you remove the ideological component, the Jewish biological component alone it makes for a less virulent Jew. You know, they're less Jewy, but there's still Jewishness in the genes. And this is the danger. Even Hank's statement that, you know, when you have a one quarter Negro, it's more visibly, more physically obvious. Yes, it is. And that's a bad thing because one quarter Jews, it's a lot less obvious visibly, but there's also psychological or mental traits, characteristics, mental characteristics that are also heritable, a certain tendency toward revolution, for instance, that seems to be inborn amongst the Jews for troublemaking, that the Jews are so proud of when they talk about it. But, you know, for when it comes to white people, this revolutionary troublemaking type of personality traits are troublemaking. They make for trouble in white societies. And that's this atavism, this potential for atavism, where genes that are sort of submerged and buried for a little while come to the surface again later. This is one of the reasons why I think the National Socialists tried to separate clearly and ban marriages for the in-between cases, was so that the solution to pollution is dilution, you know, that the one-quarter Jews would be forced to marry full Germans, and thereby the Jewish genes would be slowly filtered out, you know, reduced to such a small extent that they couldn't ever get together with other Jewish genes and arise again at atavistic style, and that the Jews would be pushed in the opposite direction and away and out. And yeah, that's the way that makes sense.
The nature versus nurture debate in regard to Jews is very interesting. And while there are certain things that are very unique to Jews, whether it's just Tay-Sachs disease or a whole other host of diseases, it's just within the Jewish person. It doesn't matter whether or not they were raised as a Jew, whether or not they're going to be expressing this, and the same thing is true for psychological disorders as well, and psychopathy. And we see a whole lot of that within the Jewish genetic makeup. Let's move on to another call here and try to wrap up this show in the next 15 minutes or so. I believe this is Marcus from Germany.
Well, I believe it may not be. Hi, Kyle. Hi, Tan Stoffel.
Oh,
how are you doing?
Looks like a similar number. Welcome to the show, Frank. Good to have you here.
Great interview.
Hi,
I want to commend you, Tan Stoffel, for your white network and the variety of voices there. I mean, on the one end, your show goes down so smooth, you know, like a bottle of Leinenfugels, whereas Carolyn is like vodka, straight. And I love that. I love that I could go from one show to the other depending on my mood. And I also like the fact that not all of your shows, not all of them anyway, are about those, propeller cap-wearing characters that are occupying so many of our conversations. I'm particularly speaking of your shows regarding early European history.
Oh yeah,
the old Europeans and the Aryan invasion thereof. I thought those were very, very well done. I don't think your shows get enough mention. It's just how expertly they're presented. In fact, I mentioned earlier, hearing you two talk, you're both so smooth talking and non-offensive in your delivery. I think this particular interview would be a great show to share with the uninitiated, because I remember playing Dr. Pierce's shows for people, And unfortunately, a lot of people are very off put by superficial things like the tone of someone's voice, you know. And Dr. Pierce comes across pretty strong, pretty brittle.
Hello.
So, yeah, this one, this show right here, guys, if anyone's in a sharing mood for friends and family, I think that'd be a great idea.
Well, thanks for the suggestion. Hopefully people do take it.
Thank you, Frank. Yeah, about what I do, and I enjoy doing those programs too, is, you know, I basically consider my podcast and a lot of my blogging, but especially with the podcast, is to be a sort of research program. It's a self-educational. It's topics that I always wanted to look into in detail, and so I take the opportunity to dig into it, figure out some things, and then I present it as a podcast. And my upcoming series is going to be focused on Mary Fagan and the Leo Frank thing, you know, the murder of Mary Fagan by Leo Frank. So I'll be doing the
Dan,
same thing
I'm
there.
Dan, I hate to ask this because I'm the kind of guy who doesn't even look at the National Enquirer when I'm standing in line at the supermarket, okay? But you're amazingly honest and honorable, and I like that in a person. Now, regarding the situation with your wife, without getting too personal, I mean, does she listen to your shows? Can I ask that?
Yeah, sure. She knows everything I say, she doesn't listen to every show, but she definitely knows how I feel about this stuff, and we talk about it all the time. And we're clear on it. We're on the same page on it, and she's down with it. Yeah, she understands.
Now there's a reality show I'd like to see. Well, anyway, I'm going to get off the phone here. And again, I mentioned your show on Wolf Wall Street's program. I said this guy Tan Stoffel. I've never heard anyone talk about him, but I've heard literally every single one of his shows on the White Network, and they're just excellent. Okay, I'm out. Take care.
Thanks, Frank. All right. That was Frank, a frequent caller here. Always appreciate hearing from him. And I'd agree with his sentiments there. I have not heard every single one of your shows yet, Tan Stoffel, but I broadcast them out onto the stream often throughout the week, so people can hopefully catch them then. But that's basically when I'm listening to them, I'll turn on the streaming technology and hopefully some other people can hear as well. And really, you go in depth and it's a good presentation and delivery. So, I think people really benefit from taking a look at those. They're about 30 minutes apiece. So it's really a good chunk of information that leaves you hungry for more.
I want to credit Carolyn for doing that, too. I mean, besides helping her to create the White Network for her use, it was she was instrumental in convincing me that I should do a podcast, and then has encouraged me since then, of course, to keep doing it and inspired me. You know, I think about the way she does things and try to do at least some of what I do along the same lines.
All right, great. Well, we have one more caller to get to here, and then we will wrap up the show. This is a caller from 540 area code. Hello, caller. Who is this?
This is Marie from Virginia.
Hi, Marie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Well,
and I just...
Do you have any questions or comments to Tan Stoffel?
Well, I just wanted to call in. I had been listening to the broadcast from Saturday, and you were talking about the White Man March that's coming up, and I thought about a good song to that could represent it is song Calling All the Clans Together, because people are so in tune to music, and I think it has such a profound effect on the propaganda effect on people. And if you listen to that song, it really, I think, has a lot of a racial pride to it.
Well, you know what? I'll go out with that song tonight. I actually already have it uploaded to the studio here. I believe it was an Urban Jungle Girl who asked me to do so. So I will end the show with that song tonight. It is a good song. And anything else you want to add to the conversation?
Well, I'll just say one more thing, kind of my take on the Jews. You know, you hear a lot of people talking about how, well, are the Jews a race? Are they a nationality? Are they an ethnic group? And, you know, my take on that is they're all the above, or any of the above, or any combination of the above. And I think there is definitely a genetic element to them, because if that wasn't the case, you wouldn't see the Jewish features or the
yes.
genetic diseases. That shows you right there is. But then we also see Jews who are diluted out with Aryan blood, who don't look Jewish. And see, I think that's why the Jews have become such masters of, brainwashing, so to speak, because they know that there are Jews that don't have the genetics for it, but yet they're, from the time they're born, they're impropagated with that, the Jewish belief, what's in the Talmud, so that if they don't have the genes for it, they're going to be brainwashed, you know, because there are some Jews that have very little Jewish blood. They might only be a quarter or even an eighth Jewish. And so...
Well, some people argue that the Ashkenazi Jews are not really, you know, the biblical Jews. There's the Khazarian take on it as well, that many of the people currently who call themselves Jews have a lot of Khazarian blood, and they were converted Jews, so
mm-hmm.
previously white people, and that's where we get a lot of these white-looking Jews from. And, you know, that could account for some of it, and it's something to think about. But as you mentioned, and as Tanstoffel has done programs on, if there wasn't a racial or rather genetic component to Jewishness, then people wouldn't be able to have such fine-tuned Judars. And there are people who have very bad Judars, but there are those who can pick up Jews just by taking a quick look at them. And that does seem to indicate that there are common characteristics with them, and that it's not just all about the brainwashing that they get within their Talmudic systems.
No, and I have noticed too, like, you know, you see a lot of programs where, you know, they talk about, you know, the big Jews, the kike Jew, you know, the ones that are the worst offenders. But I must say this, my encounters with Jews, and I mean little Jews compared to big Jews, I find that little Jews doing the same thing that the big Jews do, but on a smaller scale.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And supporting the big Jews, really, when it comes time to circle the wagons, when Jews are criticized, big and little, small,
yeah.
they get together. And the little Jews help fund the big Jews. So,
mm-hmm. And most
them.
Of the times that even though all Jews are supportive of Israel, or even if they're not supportive of Israel, they're supportive of what's good for the Jews.
Yes, that's a good insight, that a lot of the Jewish criticism from supposedly self-hating Jews, their criticism of Israel or anything Jewish is on the
mm-hmm.
basis of, well, I don't think this or that is good for the Jews, and that's why they're critical of it. They don't think that Israel,
mm-hmm.
for instance, is good for the Jews because it gathers all the Jews in one spot where they can easily be wiped out by Iran's nukes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It calls too much attention to the Jews, and they're living in diaspora amongst the Goyim, and the,
mm-hmm.
Israel makes Jews as a whole look bad, and so that's the source of 99% of Jewish criticism of Israel or other Jews. And that's a good thing to keep in mind, that that ought to be our standard for things too, that white people ought to be thinking to themselves first and foremost, what's good for white people, not what's good for everybody. How can I reduce this to a universal principle that applies equally to everyone, because I'm supposed to be searching out equal principles that are treat everybody equally like we do now. We should be thinking what's best for us. Who cares about anybody else?
Exactly, and that's one thing that since I have woken up to the racial issue, you know, I'm a baby boomer who, you know, woke up to it and finally realized that the good guys lost World War II, you know, and it's woken me up to the fact that, you know, to have pride in my race and not, you know, all the white guilt that I had has gone. And I, you know, am proud to look after my racial interest and be caring only about my own race, just as black people are, their own interest, their own racial interest. And I think it follows natural law. You have to actually socially engineer someone or a group to not think that way. I think that one of the reasons that white people don't have that natural, still have that natural ability like the Hispanics do or the blacks do is because it has been socially engineered in subtle ways out of white folk.
Right, out of our ideas anyway. It hasn't been genetically extirpated entirely yet.
No.
But they've looked into that. They've looked into ways that they can shut off different genes for racism and religious fanaticism and things. So I wouldn't be too surprised, Soon, if they're trying to genetically engineer humans that didn't even have genes for racism. I don't think they'd be able to really succeed with that. But yeah, you're right. It's been a war on the minds of the people. So their natural instincts have been subverted. If we can get people to start thinking rationally, start thinking naturally, start thinking racially, then we'd really be able to have our power start returning to us.
If we can start getting white people to think that their moral legitimacy and it comes from a moral legitimacy, and that moral legitimacy comes from themselves and from their own group and doing what's best for their group, then we can begin to fight. But as long as we are deluded into thinking our legitimacy comes from a piece of paper, or it comes from us being a majority, or it comes from us being treated to the same standards that other peoples are treated to, you know, asking them for permission to a piece of the pie, that is not going to work.
I think, Marie,
no, please go ahead.
I do think that we should follow more natural law, and you can't necessarily go by laws that are written down, because those can be altered and have amendments added to them. And look at all the laws that have been implemented just in the United States. And we've just become a society of all these laws and regulations that just have totally undermined the Constitution. And maybe when it was written, even that was a compromise, because the Articles of Confederation was what really we should have stuck to instead of going with the Constitution, and I think that maybe it was kind of a compromise.
Interesting idea. I think that it is something that was probably a compromise of sorts, and that's why they had to add on the Bill of Rights there. Marie, I'm going to wrap up the show here, though, so I wanted to thank you for calling, and we'll see if...
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Okay.
Oh, you're welcome.
Good night.
please call in anytime you'd like. Have a good night as well.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Any thoughts you have regarding the founding of America, whether or not it was actually possibly a good thing for white people, or for, maybe it was always designed to screw us in the end with these Enlightenment ideals, you know, the ones that were being put out by the French revolutionaries as well, you know, about égalité, liberté, fraternité.
I'm afraid, and I'm beginning to come to that conclusion myself, that I've always had actually kind of positive feelings about the founding fathers and the myths of the revolution and the white men and their constitution that they wrote. And so I've always been kind of down on criticism that somehow the Constitution would have got it right if they had just added a clause that said, you know, America is for white people. Because I don't think that that's true. I think, and also, as you say, that it was founded on these Enlightenment ideals that you could say it was baked into the cake, the what the Jews did in eventually taking over. But I think that this is why ideology is important, too. It's not purely genes. You have to have a memory. You have to have a racial identity that lives in the spoken word as well, that you teach your children what it means and what the pitfalls are and what you have to do to survive is not just be, not just reproduce your genes, but you also have to then teach your children properly. And part of teaching your children properly is to explain to them why it's important to reproduce with someone of your own kind, to perpetuate the race, and to be careful of and wary of infiltration and lies and manipulation from other people who have their own group and their own group's interests in their minds.
All right. Well, thank you for being here, Tan Stoffel. I've really had a great time discussing these issues with you here. I just actually wanted to end the show with a question I posed to the audience tonight over at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. On the sidebar, there's a question there, a poll. It's a multiple choice answer here, and I wanted to get your take on this, see what your answer is. And the question is, how much time do we have left? Or actually, it's a kind of a two-part question. When do we need to win this fight? And the answers are in the next year, in the next 5, in the next 10, in the next 20, and in the next 50. And thus far at the site, the vote has been pretty much evenly spread. But what do you think? How much time do we have left here before it's too late, possibly? When do we need to make this happen? In the next year, in the next 5 years, in the next 10, 20, or 50?
I don't see a time limit on it because I think it's not a matter of numbers. It's a matter of getting your minds straight doing what's necessary. But as far as prognostication or predictions of doom, if we don't do something by X date, white men have been saying that for at least 100 years and probably longer. I think of Lothrop Stoddard and Madison Grant, and even before them, I think of Wilhelm Marr in Germany writing, you know, how the Jews had victory over the Germans back in 1875. So, and only 20 years before that, what's his name, wrote The Races of Mankind. Not The Races of Mankind. Well, whatever. You know, it's just that this has been an ongoing pattern, a long decline, and we're not out until we give up. You know, until we're actually physically exterminated down to the last man and can't come back, that's the end. But and I guess that's really what the question you're asking is, when do we lose the critical mass from which we will never be able to recover? If it's up to the Jews, we will lose utterly because they don't really have compassion for us. They don't see us as fellow human beings, much less as fellow whites, and identify with us in that sense. They have us on our backs. They have their foot on our throats, and they're pushing as hard as they can, no matter what whimpering sounds we make. And so, you know, the reality is that that's the situation I think we're in, but we shouldn't give up. And whether it takes 1 year, 5 years, 50 years, I think it's going to take a long it's going to be a long struggle because it's going to require not just overcoming some short-term hurdle. It's going to take a long-term shift in how we think about who we are and what's right, what's wrong, what we should be doing. We've got to have that resolve we got to steel ourselves for what's necessary.
It sounds like you're being realistic, but there is a little bit of optimism in what you're saying. And I think you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if you didn't think it would be possible for us
to
flourish again.
Yeah, if you thought that there was no chance, whatever, you might still do it just, you know, for the pure joy of sticking your finger in the enemy's eye. I like to think that as well, but when I get really down. But let's not give up. Let's not talk about when the drop-dead date is. You know, Sam Francis was talking about the drop-dead date being maybe in 10 or 20 years ago. 10 or 20 years ago, he was saying that if we don't do something in 10 or 20 years, then we're doomed. So here we are. So according to him, who's dead now, you know, we're all doomed. And so why are we even bothering? And you can see that really thinking along those lines doesn't do anything but demoralize and demotivate and deactivate us. So let's not think along those lines. Let's think about, let's do whatever we can do. The longest journey starts with the first step. So let's start taking steps. Let's crawl if we have to, but never give up.
Yeah. Well, if we start now, if we go faster, then it'll be sooner than later. I say as soon as possible.
Picking the destination and going in the right direction is more important than how fast we travel. A little about this offline. The destination, you have to decide. You want to get to the store down the street before you set out. Otherwise, you're just going to end up someplace random if you don't pick where you're going to go. So that's important. And for us, what's important is who we are, you know, whites. What is white? Who is white? And who isn't white? The Jews aren't white, for example. And what's best for us? What's best for whites? And if that means excluding, if you got to jump on a hand grenade to save your buddy, or if the rules that need to be made for the white race to continue are going to exclude you and your family, well, then that's what's got to be done. And that's my mindset about it.
Well, I really do appreciate you being here. And I just want to encourage everybody to check out your shows over at thewhitenetwork.com. And hopefully we'll be able to get together again sometime in 2014 and discuss these ideas again. And I'm sure there will be lots of progress made by then.
I enjoyed it. Thanks very much, Kyle, and looking forward to your work in the future, too. Yeah.
All right, great. Thank you. And thank you all out there for listening to RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Check out all the great shows here, and I'll be back next week.
Calling all the clans together, calling all the clans together, calling all the clans together, brothers come a running. Calling south and north together, calling west and east together, calling all the clans together, brother come running. To be a bit of sleeping, can't afford to be a bit of sleeping. Can't you see the reaper reaping? Brothers come a running. Never mind the shells are flying, never mind the dead and dying. Can't you hear the piper piping? Brother come a running. Come a running fast, come a running hard. Running for all you worth, come a running through the gates of hell itself, and let the devil take the hindmost.
We're gonna be
calling all the clan together, calling.